This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week, I'm going to be looking at the new films, the Divergent series, Allegiant. Jeez, that's a mouthful. Miracles from Heaven, The Bronze, The Wave, and hello, my name is Doris. I'll also talk about the news, the trailer park, some box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, you can catch me at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first really big piece of news is Indiana Jones 5 is actually happening. It has been confirmed to have a release date of July 19th, 2019. 2019! This series started in 1981. That's kind of amazing when you think about it, and there are only five movies in. And that is almost 40 years difference in the release date. To put that in perspective, it would be like Bela Lugosi doing a big-budget Dracula movie in the early 70s, or at the least the very late 60s. He was dead by then. Or having Lon Chaney play the Wolfman once again in the early 80s. That is how long the difference of time for this series to have passed. Now, first of all, I am a huge fan of Indiana Jones. I loved Indiana Jones almost as much as I love Star Wars. Of course, being cut from the same cloth, and I love Spielberg and Lucas. And heck, I even liked Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. So suck it, haters. The reason I liked it is it's essentially it's an old school serial. It's the kind of stuff that they played in front of movies back in the 40s and the 50s. The reason I'm okay with it, because people said, oh, it's aliens, it wasn't the sort of the mysticism that they had in the first couple ones. I'm like, well, that was a sign of the times. I know what Lucas was trying to do with the story, because you couldn't just make it another contemporary Indiana Jones movie. And the 50s weren't about jungle adventures and fighting Nazis. The 50s were about bug-eyed monsters and aliens. That's why you had an alien connection to it. My biggest beef with Indiana Jones 4 was I just didn't like Shia LaBeouf. Now, here's my question is, since it's going to be coming out in 2019, are we going to find out that Indiana Jones is actually a replicant? Or will Kylo Ren show up at the end and kill him? I look for that to happen, honestly. Not Kylo Ren, but I have a feeling that Harrison Ford wants to cap off this character. They may pass the torch to somebody else. Who knows? They tried with Shia LaBeouf, but that kind of blew up in their face. Now, Lucas isn't involved, but you know what? I think it's not anything that he's being snubbed by Spielberg. I think Lucas is just done. Lucas has been dealing with this for so long, both Indiana Jones and Star Wars, that when he sold Lucasfilm, he was like, I don't want to bother. I mean, it's hard to look at it as a fan or as a kid when you grew up watching those movies. You're like, how can you not want to just be immersed in the Star Wars universe until you get immersed in the Star Wars universe for 40 years? It's kind of like, I go to movies all the time. I love movies, absolutely love movies. But I also like taking a break from them. One of my favorite times of year is right around Christmas, because by a couple days before Christmas, I've seen everything that's going to come out that year, and I don't have to go see another movie until after the new year. So I get this weird little 1 or 2 week period where I don't even have to go to a theater, and it's kind of fun. Now, speaking of that, that dovetails into the next piece of news I want to talk about is a little bit of an update on that whole screening room story from last week I talked about. This is, of course, where Sean Parker and a couple investors are developing an at-home viewing system. It's like $150, and then you can watch first-run movies day and date at home. Now, I, of course, have said that that's probably not going to take hold, but what's interesting, where it's sort of made a difference is in the last week or so, some pretty big-name directors have kind of come out in support or against. Steven Spielberg came out to support it, Martin Scorsese, Brian Grazer, who's a producer, Ron Howard, and J.J. Abrams, and Peter Jackson all have said that they support this new at-home viewing experience. The ones who've most notably come out against it are Christopher Nolan, James Cameron, and John Landau, who is James Cameron's production partner in movies like Avatar and Titanic. And now that's not a big surprise for those two directors to come out against it, because both Nolan and Cameron are all about large format and the technology and the presentation of the theater. Now, they're kind of different in what they want out of that. I mean, Nolan wants film and he wants to preserve film and he loves the IMAX. James Cameron is about 3D technology and the premium theater experience and pushing the limits of the technology. And he's making Avatar 2 and 3 and 4 and 16 and 18 and 28 right now. And that's been delayed. And it's quite possible that if this screening room thing catches on, it's going to change the face of cinemas before he actually gets another Avatar movie out there. And that might endanger the project, because will you be able to get the billions of dollars from Avatar that you did from the first one? But that, of course, will Avatar bring in that much money in the first place is another question. The reality is, when it comes to theatrical experience, I don't think this is going to fly, just because I think there's too many things in their way. But if it does work out, I'd probably use it. I'd be a little annoyed at a $50 price tag. And I imagine the market would affect that as well. I mean, if it went down to $20 and I could just watch a movie at home as opposed to getting in a car and driving to go see a theater, especially if they released them on Thursday nights, that's when I'd be watching them. What you're doing is you're basically merging the home video market and the theatrical market to get one big market, which split up, of course, way back in the 80s when VHS became a big thing. I think repertory houses and art houses are going to still continue to thrive, especially if they're showing vintage 35 prints and they're showing rare stuff and different stuff that you maybe aren't able to see. There's stuff that's on 35 prints that you can get from collectors that you cannot find on DVD or Blu-ray. Those places are going to be fine. It's the big chains, but the big chains don't actually make as much money. People think the movie business is just flush with cash. It's not. The theaters don't make much. Most of the money goes to the studios, and the studios are calling the shots. But in the end, your home theater experience is going to be comparable or sometimes even better than some of the projection experiences you're going to have out of the regular cinema, and then you don't have idiots turning on their phone in the front row. There were really only two movies in 2015 that I felt I really wanted to see in the theater. One of them was Star Wars, and for no other reason than I've seen all the other Star Wars movies in the theaters, and that's how I experienced them. But I would have loved to have watched it at home, too. The only one that I really felt was a different experience was Mad Max Fury Road. In the theater, in 3D, it was exhilarating, and it wasn't as strong on Blu-ray, but it was still a good movie. And that's the only one that I thought was downplayed a little bit. That's the same nuance of people caring about film versus digital, you know. And so if the screening room takes off, I'd actually be all for it, because I don't want to have to leave the house. You're listening to Fat Guys and the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one is from The Lonely Island, pop star Never Stop, Never Stopping.
Connor for Real is actually saving the record industry.
Connor's hot.
You tell me you didn't see him and say, yo, he's the star.
This guy right here, he's gonna make it big.
It's Connor.
Connor currently has 32 people on his personal payroll.
Sure, Connor surrounds himself with people who are agreeable.
You know, it takes a village to make me look dope.
I loved Hot Rod. I thought that was a hoot. I love their little SNL digital shorts. These guys are funny guys. And it looks like they were basically given, you know, whatever, $10, $15 million and said, hey, make your movie. And they're going to make their money back. And I want to see more of their stuff. Pop star Never Stop, Never Stopping opens on June 3rd. The next one I want to talk about is Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, and that opens on September 30th.
We're what's known in common parlance as peculiar.
Because our abilities don't fit in the outside world, we live in places like this. Where no one can find us. I knew you were one of us when you were born. It's time for you to learn what you can do.
But I'm just ordinary.
No, you're not. You were born to protect us.
This is a Tim Burton movie, but it's not this weird little remake of a classic. It is based on a book because he generally draws from other sources, but that's okay. At least it looks a little bit original. Looks like it has a bit of a feel of that Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events. You know, this also kind of has a Big Fish feel to it. So I'm looking forward to this one, too. I think this one might be interesting. I've always loved what Tim Burton does visually, and it looks like he might have a pretty good story behind this one. That's it for the trailer park. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Bronze, and hello, my name is Doris. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing with the show and heading into the movie reviews. We have another Olympic comedy to talk about. You know, we had Eddie the Eagle, and then we had Race, which wasn't a comedy, but it did involve Olympics. There's a lot of Olympic content this year. This is like the third movie that actually has Olympic moments in it in the last month. It's an Olympic year, so you know maybe that's why people tried to time these. Anyways, The Bronze. An Olympic bronze medalist in gymnastics has her fragile reality shattered when she faces a financial crisis and has to become a coach for a young Olympic hopeful.
She was the star of the 2004 Games.
Honey, I know you've been stealing from my truck again.
But that was a long time ago.
No more allowance.
You're cutting off my allowance and you want me to stop stealing? What kind of a sick monster are you? Come on.
Here's the deal, Twitchy. I'm the pilot. You're the
co-pilot. Got it.
I'm gonna say stewardess.
Well, well, well. Hope and Gregory. I won gold and silver, and everyone's talking about your bronze.
It's men's gymnastics, which, come on, no one gives a crap about.
I've always had a little thing for Melissa Rauch, who plays the lead, and most people recognize her from The Big Bang Theory. She plays Bernadette. And I know there are people out there who just hate The Big Bang Theory. More than anything, I mean, there are people who just are so mad that The Big Bang Theory is popular. I think it's funny, and I'm a geek. I don't think it's trotting on geek culture, but it is essentially a mainstream sitcom, and if you don't like mainstream sitcoms, you're not going to like it. But I actually thought it was kind of a great little move. This is a series that doesn't get the credit for being somewhat progressive in terms of gender politics in Hollywood that it should, because it started out as these dorky guys and basically a sexual object, which was Penny. But then it brought in Melissa Rauch and he brought in Mayim Bialik to play their girlfriends. And so now they have, a more, much more diverse cast than just a bunch of geeks. But Melissa Rauch has jumped over and trying to do movies, and she co-wrote this and stars in it. And part of what's kind of fun with this is she's so tiny and small and she has such a squeaky little voice. Well, she's not small in the chest. They actually make a joke at one point because she's a gymnast and gymnasts generally are flat chested. And Sebastian Stan's character sees her and she's wearing a low cut top and he's like, oh, you brought the career killers out, because, you know, she is very top heavy. And at least they address that, because, I mean, to talk about the elephant in the room, there's two of them sitting there right on the edge of her chest. But I've always thought she's very funny. I thought she has a wicked sense of humor, and she plays foul mouthed, mean, and cantankerous, and I think that's funny. I mean, she's basically playing the Robert De Niro character from Dirty Grandpa, and we've seen these movies before where you've got this ornery, crotchety, mean-spirited, cranky person. She's Bad Santa, you know, from Bad Santa, Billy Bob Thornton's character. That's essentially who she is, only she's this cute little gymnast. And she does a great job in it, actually, and there's some very funny moments. The nature of the way the film was made, it feels like an independent film from the 90s, actually. And you really would only understand what I'm saying if you watch some independent films, comedies in particular from the 90s. There's just sort of that feel to it. It feels a little bit out of its time. And that's okay. I think it works. I have a great affinity for 90s independent comedy films. It's not as mainstream as a regular mainstream comedy. Even for a raunchy comedy, it's a little bit out there. There's a couple times where it swerves into, I would say, unpleasant territory, especially with the character actions. That's always the thing that bothers me about movies, is when you don't like the characters. If the characters are doing something that is reprehensible beyond just being funny, it to me doesn't work, and it swerves into that category. It takes a lot longer for her character to start breaking down her shell than it probably should. But overall, I mean, it's a funny movie. I mean, I thought it's getting terrible reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, and I don't think it deserves it. I think it's funny. I thought it was clever at times. I think the acting is pretty good. I mean, Roush is good. Gary Cole plays her dad. He's pretty funny. Sebastian Stan, who's just a pretty boy. I mean, he's the Winter Soldier, but he's pretty much just a pretty boy. He's sort of the it flavor of the month right now. So he's fine in it. But it works as a movie. It's not a gold medal movie. It's not great. You know, it's not one of those that knocks it out of the park. The Bronze is actually a pretty accurate representation of my feelings for it. It's not top tier. It's not even second place. But it places. It gets to stand on the podium and hear the national anthem of maybe somebody else's best comedy piece. I'm taking the analogy way too far. Ultimately, I still enjoyed it, and I don't care that not a whole lot of other critics did. I think The Bronze is kind of cool. So I'm going to say The Bronze kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Hello, My Name is Doris. This is another indie comedy. It feels much more like a modern indie comedy, though, because it deals with hipsters and it deals with this sort of taboo subject in a very modern independent film sort of way. This one stars Sally Fields as a woman whose mother/roommate passes away and then becomes hopelessly infatuated with a younger coworker.
He's very different than me. It just seems impossible.
You need to find common interests.
He's on Facebook. Let's make a fake account.
You're taking dating advice from a 13-year-old.
Sunshine. You guys know Doris.
She's kind of weird.
She's like a good weird.
What about you, Doris? You ever been in love?
I was engaged once.
Really?
He got a job in Arizona, and he asked me to go with him. I couldn't leave my mother. It would have killed her.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I'm away.
Sally Field, I have a love-hate relationship with. I mean, I've seen some things that she's been in, and I thought she was fantastic. There is no doubt that she is a great actress. I mean, she's well-deserving of her Oscar. She was great in Norma Rae, and she was really adorable in Smoking the Bandit. But there's other stuff she's done where she's not that great. At times, she's kind of phoning in her role. She's kind of like a female Dustin Hoffman. There's some real standout performances, but then there are times where you cast her and you essentially just get Sally Field. She even came out and made a couple offhanded comments about the Amazing Spider-Man movies where she played Aunt May and kind of saying, well, she just wasn't into those movies. And it was clear. You could tell. She was just playing a role. Here, you can tell she's throwing herself into it. She's having a lot of fun with this movie. And she is quite adorable in it. And one of the things I like about Hello, My Name is Doris is, unlike The Bronze, which I talked about just now, this one doesn't get to a mean-spirited point. Now, part of the reason The Bronze exists. The Bronze is meant to be mean-spirited. This one is a sweet little comedy, and people do things that are bad to each other at times, but it's just an adorable little comedy. It's directed by Michael Showalter, who's from The State, and most people don't remember The State. They were a comedy troupe in the 90s and went their separate ways, but you see him showing up elsewhere. Reno 911 has a lot of the State comedians in it. Also David Wayne's stuff. He was in The State, and Michael Showalter was in The State, and he directs this, and it's exceedingly charming. I mean, you kind of fall in love with her character, and that makes it good. And it's originally shocking, but it's also ultimately very believable. And it's a nice movie. It's one of those movies that's a nice movie that also deals with some harsher realities of life. And she has her acting moments. There's a nice little Oscar clip in there for her. But overall, it's just a charming little film. It's worth seeing. If you can catch it, check it out. I mean, it's open in limited release around the country. I don't know if it's on VOD yet, but you always wait till Screening Room takes off, and then you can watch it at home. Or, just wait a couple weeks, and it'll be on demand. Anyways, I'm going to say, Hello, My Name is Doris. Rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Allegiant and Miracles from Heaven.
Because we can't go!
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing with the movie reviews. Let's hit the one, the big one, well, it's supposed to at least be the big one this week of new releases. Whether it's going to be the big one in the box office, that's yet to be seen. And that is the Divergent series, Allegiant. Now that the Divergents have been invited out of the walls of the city, Triss must face a new challenge as she tries to keep the revolution going. Oh, heck, I don't know. Look, I watched the whole movie and I have no idea what it's about. But anyways, here's a trailer, whatever.
When I first found out I was Divergent, I never thought it would come to this. I could never imagine that I'd be standing here. It's time to go beyond the wall.
Triss, this is not the place that we thought it was.
I have in general been okay with the young adult adaptations that have been coming out. Obviously, Harry Potter was the big one, and that's when they suddenly, and was a big one, and that's when Hollywood suddenly started to mine the young adult section of the library for the next big thing. And they did Twilight, and Twilight sucked. But then they did a Hunger Games, and I thought the Hunger Games was pretty good. And I even liked all the, a lot of the attempts along the way. I liked I Am Number 4, and some of them were less than good, like Inkheart and The Golden Compass and City of Ember and Aragon. I mean, there's a bunch of flops along the way, but I kind of liked some of these movies. But a whole bunch have never quite clicked. And I think that the whole post-apocalyptic young adult, or even just the young adult series, that's kind of worked its way out of the Hollywood system. I mean, it's been going on for 15 years. And now we had stuff like The Fifth Wave this year that just came and went with no fanfare whatsoever. A couple years ago, you had that City of Bones series. I mean, they really tried to make something work and nothing clicked. And the Divergent series was almost going to do it, and then it just kind of fizzled. The first one did okay, but it never really broke out the way The Hunger Games did, because it only made the amount of money The Hunger Games made on its opening weekend is what Divergent took in the whole run. And when they did Insurgent, which was last year's sequel, it actually had a lower box office. I mean, actually, when all was said and done, I think Insurgent made like $10 million more worldwide, which, using the 3D bump and the large format screen price tag, is not all that impressive. And now we've got Allegiant. What's interesting with Allegiant is it's not the third book. Like The Hunger Games and Harry Potter and Twilight, they've taken the final book and split it into two. Now, that worked great for Harry Potter because they made twice as much money. The difference is Harry Potter was this big, massive book, and it had kind of a dividing middle section, so you could split it into two and actually cover all that information. Twilight was more of a big, fat money grab, and it padded itself out, but, you know, you had that diehard fan base. Hunger Games suffered. The third movie of Hunger Games didn't make as much money as the other two, even though it was still a hit. And then the fourth one saw a significant drop in box office. Now, Lionsgate has blamed Star Wars for that. It's not Star Wars' fault. It's the fact that they split one book into two and they didn't need to. Now they're doing it with Divergent, and they've run away from the part one, part two moniker already. So they've released Allegiant. If you've read the books, you know that Allegiant's the third movie. And I was sitting there watching it, and when the movie was over, these women next to me were like, wait, that's it? This is the last movie, isn't it? And it's because it didn't end. It has this sort of cliffhanger-y ending, which is what you get. And you get half a story. There's no actual real arc through it, and it's very forced. But even beyond the let's try and squeeze more money out of the viewing public, and they'll never catch on. They won't know that they did two movies. I mean, The Hobbit was another one they split into three movies. And while I liked The Hobbit, it was unnecessarily split. And you saw box office returns go down for each movie. I think the splitting of books into movies, I think people are finally have had enough with it. And this is the 1-2 punch, Hunger Games and now this one. I mean, you're going to be lucky if Ascendant, which is the next movie that comes out next June, is even going to register. Ultimately, though, when it comes to the story, this is the most convoluted movie. I mean, sure, it looks nice. It's a beautiful-looking movie. It's got some great cinematography. It's got some great effects. I've never downplayed the cinematography or effects in these movies. Now, the first one wasn't as strong, but, like, Insurgent actually looked really good. It just was a dumb movie. This one looks even better, and it's even more dumb. It gets needlessly convoluted. They over-explain everything. This movie, they're constantly explaining things over and over and over again. Stuff that you don't care about that makes no sense. And then the stuff that they need to explain, they just kind of gloss over. It's very shallow thinking. It's not very well designed worldwise. And the characters are just really stupid. They're cardboard and there's no depth to them. I mean, the character of Triss is, who cares? Triss is a nobody. It's not worth watching. It is such a mess of a movie. I'm literally more confused after seeing it than before I saw it. And it just, I think that shows how shallowly written the stories in the books were. And from what I've heard is that everyone hated the final book. And they've decided to break that into two movies. No. The Divergent series, Allegiant, as bad as Insurgent was, Allegiant is worse. The Divergent series, Allegiant, totally sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's take a trip into the religious world with Miracles from Heaven. Jennifer Gardner stars as a mother whose daughter develops a critical illness, causing her a crisis of her faith.
When Anna got sick, I just couldn't understand it. Why was this loving little girl going through this?
I think your daughter is lactose intolerant.
Acid reflux.
Everything looks okay.
Everything's fine.
Everything is not fine.
Unfortunately, the tests confirm that she's very ill.
There is currently no cure for Anna's condition.
Doctor, please, this is our little girl. I'm scared, Mom.
Me too. We're not giving up.
First of all, don't watch the trailer for this movie. Literally, there are scenes from the last 5 minutes of the movie in the trailer. It gives away everything. Now, if you don't care that everything's given away, you can go see it. I mean, the title itself's a bit spoilery. Miracles from Heaven. You know, there's going to be some miracle involved at some point. There's certain elements to Miracles from Heaven that work. I mean, look, I'm a parent, and watching a movie about sick kids is tough to watch as a parent. And it's a tearjerker, and it pushes the right buttons because we're parents. We're human beings. We respond to this sort of stuff. And that's kind of the way Heaven Is for Real was. It dealt with a kid who had a death experience on an operating table. So, of course, that I saw that shortly after my son had had very routine surgery. But still, you put your kid under, it's terrifying. So it's an easy win for a lot of these categories. And on top of it, it also falls into that very standard formula where these religious faith-based movies tend to be either biblical, like Risen, and take place in the biblical time, or the young Messiah from last week, or it has some sort of medical angle to it. 90 Minutes in Heaven, Heaven Is for Real. Jennifer Garner stars in it. She does a fine job. I mean, she throws down for this movie, and I mean, it's well made. You don't have the really terrible acting that shows up sometimes in these movies. My biggest problem is there's a certain part of the theology that I think it gets disastrously wrong. It brings to the table the assumption that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to people as a punishment for sin. And that's a legitimate argument that is presented in the film. And I'm like, whoa, that's not the case. And it's never been the case. And I don't know any church that actually teaches that. There's an entire book of the Bible about how that's not true. Bad things happen to good people and we don't know why. And good things happen to bad people, and we don't know why. It's about your journey. And if you're a religious person, you have to make good with that. Otherwise, you're in a level of bargaining with a deity. And they do that as well. They stumble into that. And it's all good intentions and everything, but I think they come with that as the premise at the beginning, and that's kind of how their lives is being led. And I'm like, that's not the right way to do it. And they kind of address, well, why did this happen to us? We don't know. But like I said, this level of theology, I think, is flawed. And that's I have a problem with that if it's a faith-based movie. That's really where it tilted me into the fact that I think that Miracles from Heaven kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Wave, the box office, and the home cinema roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, finishing up the movie reviews. We got one more to talk about. There's no trailer for this one. It's a Norwegian film. Generally, for foreign films, I don't like to play trailers because just affiliates frown on you just putting a foreign language on the air without letting them know what it is. That's also one of the reasons why I don't cover much foreign films on this radio show, but this is a big enough movie that it's worth talking about, and that is The Wave. A Norwegian geologist is preparing to move to a new town, but then figures out an upcoming landslide in a fjord will cause a deadly tsunami. This is actually based on a true event that happens. In Norway, in particular, you have these huge fjords. Fjords are giant, essentially, mountains. And they have these valleys where there'll be, you know, water, and there's a huge tourist industry there. The only thing is that, as mountains tend to do, they tend to shift with the geologic processes, and sometimes you get a landslide. And what ends up happening, it's different than a tsunami that you're going to get in the ocean. In the ocean, the tsunami is where there's an underwater disturbance that's relatively small in terms of movement, but it moves the water, and a massive movement of water then builds up. And as it gets to a shore, it becomes huge, and then it engulfs towns. We all know what happened more than 10 years ago with the tsunami, the Indian Ocean tsunami. They killed 750,000 people or something like that. It was massive. Now, obviously the damage is much more localized in these fjords because a landslide comes down. But what ends up happening is the landslide lands in the lake or the river, and all that rock displaces that water, and you get this huge wave that is then channeled within the fjord to make it this massive, sometimes 30-foot wave or bigger. And I guess back in 1905, this happened, and it just wiped out a town. So tsunamis are a force of nature, and it's a massive wall of water. And this is essentially a disaster film. It's a Norwegian disaster film. And the director, who has one of the greatest names ever, Roar Unthag, I think is how you pronounce it. But who is it? A name like Roar? Isn't that the same thing as, like, who's the guy who directed, I think, the first Taken? His name's really Megaton. These are awesome directors' names that work to do action films. Now, it's a much lower budget than a standard studio disaster film, something like San Andreas. I think it was the last big disaster film we had. And they had a tsunami in that. But of course, San Andreas had, $150, $200 million behind it. Massive special effects budget and massive sets. And they had all the computerized effects. So when they had the tsunami in that movie, you know, it's wiping out Los Angeles and San Francisco. It's very powerful to see on an American movie. But this is going back old school. This is going back to a much more restrained approach to disaster pictures. So you have the very basic formula where you've got this family and you have the setup and you got the warnings coming, and then the wave hits. And that's really the best part is the buildup and when the wave hits, because that is pretty breathtaking to see. And it's pretty impressive for a relatively modest budget Norwegian film. I mean, the water isn't as good When water is one of the hardest things to animate. So, of course, when they're doing the water effects, the water is not quite there, especially if you've been watching enough of the American disaster films where they've got $100 million to perfect water. So the water still looks a little cartoonish, but it's very effectively done. The biggest problem with the wave is after the disaster hits is all the cleanup. That's generally, I love disaster movies that go all the way up to the disaster. Generally, the post-disaster is where it can get kind of boring. Go back to the old disaster movies of the 70s, like the Poseidon Adventure and Earthquake and, the Towering Inferno. It all leads up to the disaster, but even like the Poseidon Adventure and the beginning of the second act, the boat flips over and the disaster's done, and then it's just them having to survive. I'm never a big fan of the having to survive moments. I'm much more into the disaster moments because I think those are just more spectacular. And they've perfected that in the American movies like San Andreas, where you have an initial event and then you have other events coming on. And like in San Andreas, you have aftershocks, you have tsunamis hitting. And you've seen that in Independence Day, which is played out like a disaster movie. Roland Emmerich does it as the first wave, and then there's multiple waves of attack. This one always just has a one wave. No pun intended. So once you get past that, I got a little bit tired of that. And it does fall into the problem that a lot of American disaster movies fall into of saying, nothing matters more than this guy's family, no matter how many other innocent people are left to die, as long as these people survive. And that's a very tenuous thing to get past, because that's ultimately what happened in San Andreas. I mean, it's like The Rock plays a rescue worker and he abandons his job to save his family, which, I mean, you can relate to that. But how many people died because he wasn't there to save them, because he was flying a helicopter that could have been used to save other people all the way up the coast to find his wife and child? So Roar Utag has the same problems with his movie, The Wave, but still, it's pretty cool to see. And it's impressive compared to what the Hollywood does with a huge budget. And so I got to say that The Wave kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. First of all, the winners. Was I correct last week? I said Zootopia was going to win. With $30 to $40 million, it did way better than that. It made $51 million, which was huge. That's a very small drop. That's less than a 40% drop from the previous week, which is a great hold. And that's because Zootopia is a great little movie. Now, 10 Cloverfield Lane also did extremely well, but it was dwarfed by Zootopia. But 10 Cloverfield Lane didn't have to be a bigger movie than Zootopia. 10 Cloverfield Lane did perfectly well with almost $25 million, and that is a really good hold throughout the weekend, too. It wasn't terribly front-loaded, which sometimes happens with anticipated or gimmicky movies. And then you had Deadpool, London Has Fallen, Wixie Tango Foxtrot. Then the perfect match, The Young Messiah and The Brothers Grimsby, all came within about $1 million of each other, between $3.25 to $4.25 million. And that's not good for any of them, really. I mean, The Perfect Match was a low marketed film, and it was directed to a very specific audience. The Brothers Grimsby crashed and burned, and I think that they just didn't know how to market that one. And it's a bit of a hard sell. The Young Messiah did not do well, especially compared to the recent upsurge in faith-based films. And I go back to what I said earlier. I think they're diluting the market. You know, sometimes a family only has enough money to go see one movie a month. And when you have three movies a month come out, at some point you got to choose. And you got Miracles from Heaven, which is a little more accessible. And you just had Risen. So another contemporarily biblical epic might have diluted that audience. And then I think a lot of people are saving their money for this weekend for Miracles from Heaven, because that's a little more relatable because it takes place in the here and now. Now this week, prevailing wisdom leading up to this weekend was saying that Allegiant's probably going to win, but you know what? Zootopia's, with the hold that it had, it could win with $35 to $40 million. I'm going to say Zootopia is going to win with $38 million. It's going to three-peat because it's holding so strong. And with the exception of Miracles from Heaven, there's no family competition. Allegiant, honestly, it's getting bad word of mouth. It's getting terrible reviews. And I think the days are numbered of splitting books into two parts. I think people have gotten wise. I mean, people aren't dumb. Now, I mean, we've been all watching the presidential primaries. We know people are dumb. But, I mean, in general, for a lot of things, people aren't that dumb. They figure this stuff out eventually. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Couple of the Oscar winners and Oscar nominated films are out. You've got The Big Short, which was a really good movie, and you've got Brooklyn and Carol. For the less award worthy, you've got Sisters, which was still fun. And that's a good movie with Amy Poehler and Tina Fey, and Alvin and the Chipmunks: The Road Trip, which didn't get any awards whatsoever, but who was expecting it to? I still thought it was cute. I like the Alvin and the Chipmunks movies. There's also Game of Thrones season 5, if you want to catch up on that. And then Shout Factory has released 2 Chuck Norris movies this week, which is great. You have Invasion USA and Braddock, Missing in Action 3. These are going back in the old canon film library, which is a fun place to play around. It's a great sandbox to be in. Invasion USA is particularly good because it is so unapologetically crazy action. And I saw it, I came home after seeing London Has Fallen and watched Invasion USA, and it was a lot of fun. I mean, it's just, it's 80s action at its best, and it's not going to make hundreds of millions of dollars, but it was still really cool with well-defined, dastardly, over-the-top bad guys blowing up innocent people's houses. Braddock Missing in Action 3 isn't as good. I mean, by this point, they were burning out the Missing in Action franchise. But hey, if you're a Chuck Norris fan and you want to check out some old 80s canon films, these are ones to check out. They're out on Blu-ray for the first time. That's it for this week. I need to take off. Speaking of taking off, next week I'm going to be talking about Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, and My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.